It's nice seeing your grandchild, Colette.
Oh, nice name.
We would like to call the March 15th meeting of the Tompkins 2013 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Thank you. May, what's today?
October.
What? Start that again. October 15th, 2013 meeting of the legislature. I'm sorry, Colette got me all confused. Hi. Hi. You stay for a while. Would you all please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic which stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty
and justice for all. Roll call of members.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robinson?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa? Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer has asked to be excused. Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Present.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne has also asked to be excused. Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
13 members present.
Proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I would like to ask for an executive session after our regular business tonight for possible litigation and for personnel matters. A couple of things, so I hope you'll keep that in mind when we do legislative privilege of the floor. For public privilege of the floor, I have a few people signed up, and if anybody else would like, who hasn't put given us a blue form, would like to speak, then you can take a turn after the first the signed up people have gone. I've got Brittany Earle and then Kevin Kelly. You have 3 minutes, and Kathy will help you keep track. Brittany Earle, either microphone.
Hi.
It says it's on, but...
We can hear you.
Oh, okay, sorry. Hi, my name is Brittany Earle. I'm speaking on behalf of the Youth Bureau and the Brothers Big Sisters Program. I am also case manager for the program. The facts about what we are facing if the proposed budget passes have been put out there. Many letters have landed on your desk. Phone calls have been made, and people have stood before you to give their 2 cents. I'm here hoping that what I have to say will give you a different perspective. I've only been with Big Brothers Big Sisters for about 6 months. Before this, I was employed with Finger Lakes Residential Center, or as many of you know, at Lewis Gossett, for nearly 2 years. I can't say much about the budget cuts that Big Brothers Big Sisters has faced over the last several years, but I can speak directly about the power of mentoring. What actually shocked me the most about working at Finger Lakes at the time wasn't the $270,000 per year it cost to house just one youth, or the many youth I encountered that had committed grand larceny, rape, assault, and yes, even murder. Even though it was all quite shocking, it was actually the moment, it was actually the amount of youth I saw over and over again. And yes, some of those youth came from Tompkins. It always intrigued me on why they came back time and time again. The kids who I felt a closer connection to, I would ask them, why do you keep putting yourself in these situations that jeopardize you? Aren't you sick of coming back to this place? And the majority of them would say, I have no one out there waiting for me, no one to show me a better way. These kids went home to struggling parents, alcoholics, drug addicts, family who were sick of their behavior, gangs, no food, poor aftercare, and most importantly, to no one who took the time to listen to them, to encourage them, or to show them the person they're capable of being. Mary Ann McCure, a news reporter for WNYC, reported that study after study has shown that incarcerating kids is unlikely to keep them out of trouble in the long run. A shocking 89% of boys end up back in the system by the time they're 28, she said, or nearly every 4 out of 5 youth. And Commissioner Gladys Carrion said, the one-to-one relationship has been the exception in the troubled system. There are several programs in Tompkins County that are geared towards rehabilitating youth. Our program is geared towards preventing the unfortunate pitfalls at risk youth face. It's easy to think that Big Brothers Big Sisters is just a cute, friendly program.
1 minute.
But we do so much more than that. The majority of the youth we serve are at risk, and these are the children who need our services. I don't think it's easy to overlook the impact that mentoring has on a child, and I can guarantee that there is at least one person you can credit for having a positive impact on your life. Thank you.
Brittany, before you leave, you mentioned a percentage of boys who are back in the system. What was the number again?
89%.
Thank you. Kevin Kelly, and then Pete Myers.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, and I'm board president of Opportunities, Alternatives, and Resources of Tompkins County. And I've been president there for about 4 years. And I came to thank you for the recommendation of an increase of about $3,000 for 2014. That will allow us to continue our current caseload through the year. And I do expect, though, with the expansion of the jail in the following year, to have an expanded caseload. When I started as president about 4 years ago, we had 3 full-time caseworkers in addition to the executive director and a part-time bookkeeper. Through the recession, I want to thank you for your funding through that. But we did have to cut down to 2 full-time caseworkers, and we did cut down our hours to stay a living wage provider, providing employer. But going into 2015, I anticipate that we will be looking for more funding to continue and to increase back to the level it was 4 years ago, especially with the expansion of the jail. So thank you for your time, and I can take any questions.
Thank you. Pete Myers, then Reverend Rich Rose.
Hi, my name is Pete Myers. I'm the coordinator of the Tompkins County Worker Center here in Ithaca, New York. Tonight we are actually making our first installment of petitions that is supporting a living wage for all Tompkins County contracted workers. You see a blown-up version of that being held by Ed Zeno right here. And right now I'm going to have Carl Foyer, one of the founders of the Worker Center, and Pastor Rich Rose, pass out a copy of the petitions to each county legislator. We actually have 1,157 signatures on a petition that says this. The Tompkins County Worker Center is working to ensure that all businesses and organizations that contract with Tompkins County or receive economic or community development assistance are required to pay all of their workers at least a living wage as defined and updated by Alternatives Federal Credit Union every 2 years. Right now, Alternatives is defined in the living wage as $12.62 an hour with health insurance provided and $13.94 without insurance. As I read the rest of the petition, I'd like to ask everybody who's in support of this, who came tonight, if you would please stand up in solidarity with this initiative. The people who signed the petition, everybody here signed them in addition to 1,147 other people, says, by signing below, I attest my strongly held belief that all workers employed by businesses and contracting with Tompkins County must receive at least a living wage. I affirm my willingness to pay a small increase in county taxes to subsidize local nonprofit agencies that cannot truly afford to pay all their workers at least a living wage. I also attest my strongly held belief, and we haven't gotten here yet in terms of our campaign, that all recipients of county economic development assistance and or community development assistance should also be required to pay their workers at least a living wage. And I will add that it's only Tompkins County residents who signed this petition. We were pretty diligent in going through all the petitions. People outside the county, we would cross those names off. I want to also say that a couple weeks ago, I actually looked at the county's budget online, the proposed budget, and noticed that there was an increase in contingency funds from $772,000 to $887,000. And I would really like people to think about that extra $115,000 to go towards a living wage contingency fund.
One more minute.
That would, as the study of contractors takes place in the next 6-9 months, that we actually think about how the county could kind of put some of that money towards the employers, especially the employers that couldn't potentially afford to pay that extra money. I really firmly believe that if we're committed to this for the nonprofit agencies especially, we need to put our money where our mouth is if we believe that a living wage is what Tompkins County is all about. And I do want to emphasize for those who don't know, Tompkins County is our largest certified living wage employer with over, I believe, 750 employees. So my firm congratulations to Tompkins County, one of our first. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Reverend Rich Rose.
Good evening. I have the privilege of serving the church that you can see right outside your window, and I want to say that this is a beautiful room, and so it's a privilege to be in this room. It's almost as beautiful as the First Baptist Sanctuary. Not quite, but very nice. So I want to talk to you as well about a living wage. There's this famous story in the Bible that maybe you're familiar with. The freed slaves from Egypt, the Hebrews, are wandering in the desert, and they're hungry, and they cry out to God, and they ask for food. And they are all given the same amount of bread, manna, some people call it. If they take too much, they gather too much, more than they need, it rots. If they take too little, they get just what they need, so that everyone has enough. It seems like God was trying to say there needs to be an equitable understanding that everyone has their daily bread. We also know a famous prayer, give us this day our daily bread. What I would like to really emphasize with you is the moral and ethical responsibility of this body to see that everybody who works hard in Tompkins County receives a living wage, that hard work should be rewarded, and people should not have to struggle, work two jobs, wonder if they're going to pay their rent or their heat, worry about how they're going to feed their kids or not, whether they're going to eat less. These are terrible decisions, terrible, terrible decisions that no one who works full-time should have to make. And I think you know that. I think deep in your heart you all know that. And you have the power and the ability, and that's why I'm appealing to you, to make this a reality for every county worker, whether they're subcontracted or not. And you've made an enormous step and made a wonderful, wonderful step to say that we want to be and we are a living wage employer as a county. So let's make sure that no one is left out, that everyone has enough, that there is enough manna for every person. And I know that deep in your hearts, you all know and understand the importance of this. You appreciate your paycheck when you get it, as I do. And you would like every person in this county, I think, to feel a sense of pride and dignity and that they are a contributing citizen when they look at their paycheck. And not to feel like, oh my goodness, how in the world am I going to stretch this to just basically survive? No one should be in that position. And certainly no one who's working hard and doing good work, important work, and necessary work. And I feel embarrassed when I go to the recycling center and know that those folks who are doing awful work, dirty work, smelly work, work that we probably wouldn't choose to do, are not being paid a living wage. That, to me, is tragic. And I so value that work because I'm a serious recycler, as many of you are. So please, please, look down into your hearts and say to yourselves, how can we right this? How can we right this wrong and make this a reality for every worker, subcontracted as well as not subcontracted, in Tompkins County? Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Reverend. Would anyone else like to address the legislature? All right, legislators. First, let me, is there, I think I saw Dan Klein come in. Would you like to address Dan be town board member? Are there any other municipal officials? Thank you. Hi, Dan.
Thank you, Martha. I just wanted to give a quick report on the Danby Town budget. We've released a preliminary budget. And we actually have good budget news, which is something you don't hear very often. We are actually going to have a decrease in our tax rate of 0.3%. So it's not a huge amount, but it's a good direction to go in. That'll be a decrease of $1.90 per 100,000 of assessed value. So average home will, tax bill will go down approximately $3 if their assessments stay the same. So, and we're having our continued budget meetings next Monday, the Monday after that, and then our budget hearing is on November 7th. Thank you.
Great. Any questions for Dan? Will.
Dan, how did you achieve this decrease?
Well, you know, part of it is just the luck of the draw of where people are building and what our assessments are doing. But we've initiated a couple of things, including a long-term highway department plan for truck replacement instead of doing it without a plan in advance. So we've got a multi-year plan going for that. We have a great bookkeeper. We have a great town board that's been keeping our assessment, keeping our tax rate below the 2% tax cap every year. We've also got some, we've been putting money in reserves. We have a good pension reserve that we actually haven't touched yet for this budget. So we're in good shape.
Glad to hear it.
Thank you.
Nate?
So, Dan, you said that was the tax rate, but is that, what about the levy?
The levy's going up slightly, and it's mostly due to increased retirement costs, like everybody else is getting those. Okay, the increase in the levies.
All right, but you're still under the tax cap.
We're still under the tax cap.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dan. Legislators. Pam.
I just want to thank everybody for coming down here to express your interest in the livable wage issue. I think I really appreciate the fact that you have taken this on. I think it's something that it is important that the county look at seriously and do something about. I don't expect that we're going to do it all at once, but I, for one, want to see us do something. But anyway, I just wanted to make sure that you knew how much we appreciate the fact that you have brought this issue to us and continue to remind us how important this issue is. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Frank?
Thanks, Martha. I just want to remind you that this Friday, the grand opening of the coffee shop for TCAT over on Green Street is taking place, and there'll be a formal ribbon cutting. We've invited the mayor and Gary Ferguson, and please stop by. The festivities will begin about 10 and go from there. But please take a moment and enjoy the new coffee shop at the main bus stop for TCAT. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Anyone else? Mike.
The election is only 3 weeks away, and there are some important state issues on the ballot that I hope folks will take time to look at and read the sides of and understand them a little better. I'm very concerned about the proposition to expand gambling in New York State. I'm fully aware, as the Ithaca Journal editorial pointed out today, that there is gambling in New York State, which has been allowed on the Native American reservations. And I'm fully aware that, yes, it might be a little more income for the, particularly the counties where the potential sites for casinos are located. And it maybe even be some more money for Tompkins County. But I really question whether that is the way Tompkins County ought to look for new revenue. Who would ever want to say no to having more money? Well, it's how it comes. And Tompkins County, at least twice, maybe three times, has said no to off-track betting here. One time when I was on the legislature and it went to referendum and the people said no. Gambling was always, in the old days, just called a vice, and it was strictly prohibited because of the dangers it had to families and to incomes, the way it impacted some of the folks with the least money to be able to use it on that kind of entertainment or the hope of perhaps striking it big and having a better retirement. We've had lotto for a long time, but I just would ask any of you to think of the times that you've stood in line at a convenience store or grocery store or other place and watched people buy the scratch-off tickets and knowing that it's their payday and that they're really hoping to make a little bit more money and they're really losing money against. We've heard people talk about the living wage, and many of them don't have living wage, and yet they spend it on that. I know it may not be popular to say I'm going to vote against this constitutional amendment, but I think in the long run we would be better not to have it, and that's my opinion.
Thank you, Mike. I'm going to take Stanley out of turn here. I saw you walk in just after we finished the public privilege. So, Stanley McPherson, 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Stanley West McPherson. I live at 509 West Clinton Street. I'm here for the living wage based on the companies that are making millions. We're working for them. We don't have a living wage. We're in poverty. We know that money is being generated through the county. We do know that we're making the company's money. We know that the economy for this county
at least, is moving. We do know that this county signed contracts. My company has the most contract, 10 years. We know that the county is very much aware of a living wage. We do know that the county can pass a resolution, put a bill in place based on living wage. We do know that the county is a living wage employer. Now, being that we has organized this and rallied around this and brought it to the eyes of the people, society, those who have not received a living wage, we do know that we need a living wage.
One more minute.
And for one person to say we don't need a living wage, all I ask him is he can have my paycheck and give me his. And I know he'll change his mind and he'll want a living wage as well. Thank you very much. A living wage is needed and the bill is needed to be on the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stanley. Carol, did I see your hand up? No? Okay. Peter?
I'd just like to echo Mike's thoughts about the gambling that is going to be on the ballot. I personally will vote against it. I'd vote against it no matter what it said because of the reasons that Mike said. But I am particularly appalled, absolutely appalled at the affront to democracy to have a resolution come up with only arguments for it and no arguments against it allowed on the ballot. I think that is disgraceful, and I think it undermines the whole fair structure of what an election means.
Now, Carol.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree that I appreciate when people come and speak to us on any topic, and I appreciate this group that came tonight. I just wanted to mention that it would have been my night to do the Youth Award, and I put out a call on my neighborhood listserv, actually both of them, and I did call and look in the file. We don't have a lot of nominations in place. And I would just appeal to people out watching, people here, if you know of county youth who are eligible, 19 and under, who have been particularly helpful in the community, we do have an award. We can grant it as often as once a month. We don't always grant one. I brought Colette instead, and she's not eligible. She doesn't actually live here, but she is my motivation for doing all that I do in the community. She's my motivation for fighting climate change. She's my motive, which we do have something on the docket for tonight related to that and high-volume hydrofracking and calling on the governor. She's my motivation for doing all of that. She's my motivation for just wanting to make a better society for everybody and believing that if we have a better society for all, with fairness and equity for all, it makes us all stronger. Not only those who are currently at the bottom, it makes those who are at the top stronger to have a stronger society. And so thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for letting her gavel in. And I'm having a great time during her visit. She leaves tomorrow. So you'll have me back full time. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol. Anyone else? Kathy.
Thanks. I've got three things. First, I'm always happy to see people standing up for what they believe in, and I know sometimes it's hard for people to speak publicly, and I especially for those that don't often do public speaking, I want to say how much I appreciate your doing that and also how proud I am of you. I've been getting contacted a lot by folks with regard to the money for youth services. I'm probably not putting this right. And I want to say how much it has moved me to see the support that there is for this program. And I think that's connected with the living wage. And I think that there's a way that people don't always recognize the connections between the issues that we deal with and how they impact us locally. And I'm going to jump on what Mike and Peter and also Carol alluded to, and that's the referendum that's coming up. It's an interesting situation for me because there's a number of people that benefit from gaming in that it is unionized to some extent. So there's SEIU and some other unions that feel real strongly that it offers jobs. However, this is a time when I stand in opposition to the notion of government making money off of revenues from gambling. Especially when we rely on it to meet our bills, it becomes problematic. Just as the folks that Mike was talking about who try to make enough money to meet their bills by gambling their basic money and lose. I saw one day a guy at the filling station, and he was very intent on something. He was hunched over, and I went in to pay my money, and when I came out, I realized there was a pile all around him of scratch-off tickets, and at that point, he had one, and he was taking it back in. And that's what I think us relying on expanding gambling in New York State would be. I know that for some business interests, there's a feeling of, well, me too, since Native Americans have been allowed to have gambling, that it's time for other interests to get their share. I think that the social ills that accompany gambling are indisputed, and that for us in Tompkins County to support that, even if it's in other counties, is unconscionable, especially when the argument that's being used is, don't worry, it's not here, but we get to bring home money. It's so good for us. I'm not going for that. And this, again, is related, as far as I'm concerned, with living wage. The notion that we should allow big corporations to come in and that they should go to other counties and support gaming and call that tourism so that we could have a few extra $1,000 or $100,000 is antipathy to the notion of paying everybody a living wage in Tompkins County. It's not just the dirty jobs, which are the ones that people often don't see in the backs of restaurants, the healthcare facilities doing the dirty work, and those are the ones that come to mind. But we all know people right now who are struggling with two or even three jobs just to pay their basic living expenses that have to choose, am I going to buy medicine or am I going to pay the rent? I think that the kind of investment that we need to make locally is in our people. When we think about young people that need guidance, that need mentoring, part of what would actually help them and might help them not to have people being away from the home is if there were a living wage being paid. So you can see all this connects for me, and I feel very strongly that we need to figure out a way to implement living wage across the board, sooner rather than later, and in amounts that are significant. And I believe that it's going to be a struggle for us because our system's broken, and we have to stand in the vanguard here. We have to stand not just in disagreement, but more or less in defiance of the whole system that says that we should be making money off of gambling interests in other communities rather than investing it in our own community residents. But I think we can do this. We're accustomed to this. We did push back. We fought back against being forced to build a bigger jail than we felt was necessary at the time. We can do this. There's just a way that we have to come together in an understanding of what our community values are and where they're consistent. Last, I want to close with speaking about someone who I think was a tremendous role model for so many in this community. Last week I spoke of Maggie Goldsmith. There's probably four other people I could talk about tonight, but because of the personal impact that Lucille McBean had on my life and so many people's lives locally, I want to take a minute to just acknowledge the impact that she had on youth in this community, on so many adults. You know, I was listening to people reminiscing about her and saying how she was hard on people. She would make people hold to a higher standard, but she did it in a way that was completely open and giving and loving. And I think that's, in our community, the kind of role that we should play in the sense of holding corporations and employers that can do it, and by that I mean larger employers, especially multinational or national employers, to a higher standard, and to say to them, this might be hard for you, but you've got to do it, and we'll all be better for it in the long run. So I just want to say God bless Mrs. McBean, and let's hope that the good that she brought to our community fills in all these places that she believed in and that we all need to support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy Luce. Anyone else? All right, thank you. From my report, just a couple of things. On the ballot on November 5th, there are also, I believe, two other measures related to land in the Adirondacks being swapped, and I'm going to admit my ignorance here. One of them is good and one of them is not. And if somebody can remember which one is which, but I've heard a few news stories on these. So it's something to really look into. It really matters. Will, you have the information? Great.
So I think the one that I'll be supporting is Proposition 4, which is basically giving up some claims that the state had on some disputed land, and in exchange we'll get new land. But I'm really glad you mentioned that. I almost was going to raise that, because the other thing is very, very frightening. As everybody knows, we have this wonderful, wonderful preserve, the Adirondack Park, which is constitutionally forever wild, and it's an extraordinary preserve. And there is a proposal on our ballot basically to do a land exchange that would allow mine companies to come in and give a little land and supposedly give us more land, but the land they're giving up, the land that we would be giving up, involves old growth forest. And regardless of the merits of the deal, it will be setting a precedent that will change something that has existed ever since that park was created, which is essentially once the land goes in there, it's there. And I think take time to find out about that, because it's very worrisome.
Thanks very much, Will. So that number 4 is just almost a technical thing. That's what I've heard, that some individuals had some claims that need to be settled. Do you know the number of the other one?
I'm looking.
Okay.
Sorry.
And I would just point out that the polls are open November 5th, 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. And while Will's looking, number 5 is the one where the mining company and the old growth forest would be sacrificed. Thank you very much. I would also point out that this body will not meet that night, will not meet on election night. We always put off our meeting the 1st of November on election night. We actually put it off two nights. So if anybody's looking for us on the tube, you'll find City Council instead. We will meet next on November 7th, Thursday at 5:30. I just want to mention that on Monday morning, I had a great opportunity to, along with Joe, help celebrate the 100th anniversary of cooperative extension in this county. And there was a great turnout at the 4-H Acres. We heard from David Call, whose wife Mary was the first woman chair of this body. She was also there. But David had been instrumental in establishing Cornell Cooperative Extension, in working with him when he was at the university. And Cindy Noble, who had been the first woman director of Cornell Cooperative Extension in Tompkins County. And they had some wonderful stories to tell about about the early days and the move from, what was it called, freezer? Do you remember the building that we're in, the community freezer?
It was a community freezer where
freezer plant they call it.
Freezer plant, thank you.
Freezer, right, okay. So and it was
it's the brick building down on foot where Fulton runs into to Meadow.
So thank you, Will. And they had then had a whole day's worth of activities related to the work of Cooperative Extension. And it was a great celebration of an organization that's very entrepreneurial in the sense that whenever somebody's got a good idea, they'll provide the support, the staff, the space to for that person to take it ahead. And we've seen many, many community organizations get their start under the umbrella of Cooperative Extension. So I was honored to be invited to speak, and it was, along with Gene McPheeters, it was a really nice event, and congrats to Cooperative Extension for 100 terrific years. So that is my report. If there are no questions, we'll go to County Administrator Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Martha. I really, I just have two items in my report tonight. Beginning with the federal budget, I don't know what to report on the federal budget. We've got the internet on. We're watching. We're on standby. I've tried to brief you on the fact that we are preparing contingency plans in case the shutdown lasts beyond the latter part of this month. What to do. It looks like in most cases we'll begin to hit the wall in some programs sometime in early November. Workforce investment, even the WIC program, could face a loss of funding by then. They're living on borrowed time. So all that contingency planning is underway. I've alerted department heads to the fact that if the debt ceiling isn't lifted and if the economy begins to slip, we will have to begin taking the common sense actions to try to respond to a change in the economy, like beginning to manage our attrition a little more tightly than we had the luxury of doing over the last couple of years. So everybody's on standby. Everybody's waiting to see what happens over the next couple of days. Hopefully, cool heads will prevail and people will come to their senses again. The other item that I have that's much more local is a request for a reappointment. And I've briefed you by email to let you know that I hope to have you consider a reappointment tonight. Before I get into that, though, I'd like to know if anybody would like to bring this into executive session to talk about this particular appointment. If not, then what I would like to do is just give you a little bit of background on the appointment, the individual that we're talking about, the process that has led us to this point tonight, and then ask you at the end of that if you would consider making a motion and then a voice vote to reappoint Patricia Carey as Commissioner of the Department of Social Services. This is one of the three positions in county government that have a term limit. It's actually a term that makes sure that we can only terminate someone for cause during the period of the term. And these terms are required by the state because these positions have particularly close relationships with the state. So the three positions are the Personnel Commissioner, who's the administrator of the civil service process for the state here, Public Health Director, and the Commissioner of Social Services. And we're here tonight to ask for, again, the reappointment of Patricia Carey to the Commissioner of Social Services. It's a five-year term set by charter in the state. Patricia Carey is about to finish her second five-year term. It will expire in early November. So what we're here to talk about tonight is a reappointment that would give her another five-year term that would carry through 2018. With respect to the process that's led to this point, and I've tried to explain to all of you what we've done, as we did a couple of years ago when the personnel commissioner, when her term was being considered for reappointment, we did basically a 360. We surveyed the employees of DSS. I reviewed my evaluations of the commissioner. I talked to the Health and Human Services Committee a couple of times to get input. And it's really based on the sum of all those things that has led me to recommend strongly that we do reappoint Patricia Carey. For background, she's known to all of us. She's been here since 1990. She was hired as a typist in the personnel office, and she worked her way up to become the Commissioner of Social Service, our largest and most complex department. She went over to DSS in 1991. She worked her way up. She's held the position of commissioner since 2003. I think all of us would agree she has maybe the toughest job in the county, and she's performed it very well. She's a very adept, nimble manager. She's very creative. She's seen us through a devastating economy where the demands for her services and the services of that department have escalated greatly, well beyond the additional resources that we provided her to get through that situation. All of my reviews of her have been very positive. I find her to be a very strong manager. When her employees were surveyed, they basically reinforce that sense that they view her also as a good leader and a good manager. In virtually every case, that her most frequent score was excellent in those ratings. I think that speaks well of her as a manager and a leader of that department. And when we looked at the direct reports only, the ratings by those individuals were even higher. The people that know her the best rated her the highest. If there was any area in there that was lagged a little behind the other scores, it was in internal communications. We've talked about that. She's recognized that that's an area that she will be focusing on during her next term if you agree to do that. Just a couple of other comments about her performance in that position. We care a lot about diversity and inclusion in this organization. And over the past 6 years, the portion of her workforce that is made up of underrepresented individuals has doubled. So currently 8.4% of the DSS roster is comprised of minority employees, which is a very strong improvement. So again, I don't want to lay too much on this, but I think everyone would agree, and I polled Human Services Committee. I think they all agreed that her reappointment is warranted. So I would recommend that reappointment tonight. I can take any questions you may have on this, but again, at the end, I would like to ask for a voice vote to authorize that reappointment.
First, Nate, did you want to talk about the prior topic?
Oh, yeah. Just,
okay, well, we'll come back to about the federal. Okay, Pat?
I would move that Patricia Carey be reappointed as Commissioner of Social Services.
Seconded by Frank?
Thanks, Martha. On behalf of the Health and Human Services Committee, Joe's absolutely right. The committee had several meetings, two or three, and we had an opportunity to review a lot of the material, and which we did in executive session. So I think everybody was pretty much on the same page as far as the reappointment goes. At least the Health and Human Services Committee was very supportive, and we had several questions that were answered, and I think Joe's outlined and summarized those pretty well. So I'd urge your support for the reappointment on behalf of the Health and Human Services Committee and myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Anyone else? Well, I'd like to say that I was on the search committee. When you said ten, the second five-year term, I guess, yeah, we're coming. It's about that. That sounds about right. And I know that anytime I've had to bring something to Patricia, you know, we all probably get concerns that go to the Social Services Department. She's always been responsive and very careful to make sure I know my role and her role, that she takes in the information and gets what she needs to know from me. And then that usually is where it stops because of privacy concerns, but she's always there to answer any concern. She's led her staff through not just kind of attrition and erosion of their roster, but at a time when the workload has climbed dramatically. And it's just, for example, in highway, if you lose staff, I mean, we don't increase the number of roads to plow or fix. We've lost staff in social services, and they've had many, many more people to work with and for. So, and the Affordable Care Act has been a new job of work, and that whole transition has been part of her responsibilities as well. So I think she's certainly deserved another term, and I'm pleased that that the evaluation came out the way it did. So I'm happy to support it. Is there any more discussion? All in favor of the motion, please raise your hand.
Aye.
That's unanimous. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
And Nate?
I just wanted to talk about a local effect of the shutdown. And obviously, I mean, we've heard a lot about the shutdown and, of course, the looming debt crisis, which could bring us to a next recession. But I think getting a local perspective is important. And so just today, so this is the only today how the shutdown affected me and my work. So I'm in charge of emergency preparedness and safety at Robert Packer Hospital. And our, at the end of this month, the manager of safety and I were supposed to go to an OSHA conference to learn best practices so we can reduce employee injuries. And that conference has been canceled due to the shutdown. Then one of my managers in charge of emergency preparedness, he finished his 200-level class for an incident command in order for FEMA. And he needed to finish that 200-level class so he can do further training down in Anniston, where they do a lot of training at the federal level on FEMA and disaster response. And he took his test, and it was supposed to be processed on the website and submitted back to him. But then the shutdown happened right at that time, and he has no results on his test. And also the certainty of the rest of that program is also up in question. And so that is two very major areas, employee safety and also emergency preparedness for a hospital, that are being affected because of this federal shutdown.
Frank?
Yeah, Nate, thanks for reminding me. One of the other effects has been the health exchanges. There's been initially, because of some of the access, there's been some difficulty in some people accessing the exchanges, and that's created some consternation. The state is trying to clean some of that up, but if you run into any snags or hear of any constituents that do, it would be helpful to know that, because we can get word back to some of the individuals that are trying to clean things up at this point. But Joe also mentioned that one of the programs, he just quickly highlighted a couple, but one of the programs that we could be faced with if this thing doesn't get cleaned up real quick is the WIC program. That could be severely impacted by their recalcitrances, politely as I can say it. I mean, you have a bunch of children in Washington that aren't talking to each other, and we're all going to suffer, and some of our programs are going to suffer along with the recipients. Thank you.
Well, I actually would say that the entry into the Affordable Care Act, I'm not sure that the shutdown had any effect on that. I think there was just the crush of people trying to log on and sign on, and they'll work it out. But I, the funding was separate from the shutdown, which is why I went ahead. I would have another example. I talked to somebody today who put a purchase offer in on a house, and they had they were applying for an FHA loan. That was their source of financing. There were competing purchase offers, and even though theirs was one of the strongest, the seller looked at their financing and said, well, you know, you don't have the approval from FHA. We don't know when you're going to get it. You don't know when they'll open up again and even be able to consider your application. So we have to go with somebody else. So these folks lost the opportunity to buy the home that they were prepared to buy and wanted to live in. So that's because the government wasn't open to process that loan application. I'm sure they'll find another house at some point. Maybe they are stuck until it reopens. But that's one of those things that is irreversible. That particular event is not going to be fixed. So there's some real consequences, and we're all watching and hoping that somehow this gets worked out. So I'm glad that it's good to know you're watching in real time. Thank you, Joe. Peter?
We all seem to be sort of talking out of order, but I have a question for Nathan. Is the New York Exchange, is that a state-run exchange or the federal exchange?
No, it's a state-run exchange. Yeah, it's mostly in more, I guess you could say, conservative states that the federal government's running those exchanges due to governors that have chosen not to establish the state ones.
Oh, I thought it was the other way around. Okay, I see what you're saying.
So the state-run ones are the ones that are usually supportive of the health care.
Do you have any idea whether, in fact, they're actually signing anybody up?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Absolutely. Yeah. The website was absolutely maxed out the first day. I've heard, if not hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people have signed up already.
Uh-huh.
Now, also, what's helpful about the website, and this is for any public that's watching, is that the website integrates IRS databases into it. So you don't even have to go onto the website with like paperwork in hand to fax or send to anybody. I mean, it will tap into the necessary government sources so that you can establish your income levels to figure out what type of subsidies and help you can get. It's pretty neat.
Okay, thanks.
And as we heard when we had Gene McPheeters and Bev Chin here, people have really time to sign up. Anybody who's listening and not sure what to do, there's, I think, till December 14th, you can sign up and have your policies go into place on January 1st. But you can sign up through the end of March, is that right, Nate, to have to sign up without having to pay a penalty? Frank.
Yeah, and I thought you were going to say it when you mentioned Gene McPheeters, but Gene also gave us a report, perhaps it was at another committee meeting, that she went through it with an individual at a business, and it went very smoothly.
Yeah.
The reference I was making was because at times, just like you mentioned, Martha, about the FHA, an individual going in and having to access some information that needs a federal intervention, a staff member, that's where the confusion is. And one other office that Pat and I are familiar with is the office up at NRCS, the Natural Resources Office, that's affiliated with the Soil and Water Conservation District. The district manager is furloughed. He's not there because the USDA is closed. So any funds that any farmer or anyone in agriculture was anticipating is just not getting them. So the consequences, everything hasn't been in the paper. Anyway, thank you.
All right. Jim.
I'm really interested in listening to all the potential negative things that can happen, and I too have watched those things sort of be generated in the news media. But what impresses me most of all, I grew up in a household. My mother was born and raised in New York City, and my father was from Amish country in Pennsylvania. He was an arch conservative. My mother was a raging Democrat. And she always said to me that you have to have respect for elected officials. They are trying to do the right thing for us all. And what impresses me about what's going on now is the Professor Irwin Corey double talk that comes out of D.C. from people who are narrow-minded, single-issued, and want to maintain the status quo. And the status quo seems to be this day a really mucked-up government. And it's amazing to me that they literally can turn around and look at their constituents and say, I'm doing what you want me to do. And it's frightening to think that kind of narrow mind stuff happens in the federal government. And you just wonder, the other things we can survive, can we survive all of that in the next 15 or 20 years? It's boggling.
Luckily, Jim, the congressional gym is still open, and so those congresspeople will be able to run away from their constituents when that time comes. Yeah.
I knew there was a good note somewhere.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you, Joe. County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
One thing, sort of an update. A few years ago, if you may remember, this body got a report on assigned counsel. And one of the things in the report is that there was some suspicion that there were maybe some people who were getting assigned counsel who shouldn't be getting assigned counsel. So this body asked the county attorney's office to work with the assigned counsel office to find out whether that was true, and if so, to try to recover whatever monies there were. So over the past 2 years, we've found about 12 cases where that's true. Most of them for relatively not a lot of money. Most of them range between like $500 and $800. So we have aggressively tried to recover. We've recovered close to $5,000, and it looks like we'll recover another couple thousand. So all in all, it seems to be a small problem, not a huge problem, but something which I think now we have well in hand. And that's my report.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. Nate?
So I'm sorry, Jonathan, but 12 doesn't mean too much to me. I need to know the total number is. I mean, what is that? Is 12 out of what percent of that of the whole is that?
It's a real. I don't know the whole number, but it's a very small number. Joe probably knows how many in a year. I mean, it's several hundred.
I should, but I don't offhand.
Yeah, it. I mean, they assign several hundred a year. It'd be about six a year. Uh-huh. So it's a very small percentage.
Okay.
I guess in the right. 1% or
something. Okay, all right. Like that's good to know. All right, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. Finance Director Rick Snyder.
Good evening. I'd like to bring you a short report tonight on our current status as far as the Moody's rating. The county will be refinancing its 2004 Series A bonds in November this year. That $9.3 million bond issue will be priced to sell on November 5th. We anticipate a present value savings with that refinancing of 5.5% and a total budgetary savings of $525,000. That equates to about $75,000 a year less for each of our annual budgets going forward. We recently had Moody's review our financial position, and this is the second time I've been through this in the short time that I've been here, and our whole purpose was to see if we could have our rating upgraded. As you are aware, our rating going into this was AA1, and we supported our proof of being a first-class city by giving them extensive financial analysis, updates from our most recent audited financial statements, additional information, and we actually had some conversations with the rating analysts. And as a result of that review, Moody's kept us at the assigned rate of AA1. With a stable outlook. With a stable outlook. And I might add, Joe was disappointed because he had worked hard on this, as other members of staff have. We had help from Jay in the assessment office. We had help from Kevin, even though he was very busy with the budget. It takes a full team of staff members to supply all that documentation. But I wanted to report on the good parts and the bad parts that have come out of that report. In the past, the county lost points because of what they claimed was a high level of properties that had been exempt from property taxes. This time, our county administrator spoke to this particular issue, and he demonstrated our new paradigm argument, which basically consisted of proving that our property tax exemption level really is not that bad a thing. And this argument demonstrated growth and stability that this county enjoys that is a result of, in part, of having a large institutional presence. A lot of that has to do with low unemployment figures, which we shared with them, the large number of economic properties and construction that's being planned over the next 3 years. There was a lot of ways that we could demonstrate that having the colleges in our town was a very, very positive thing. After our rating was reported to us on Friday, I spent some time on the phone with the rate analyst, and he agreed with us that the institutional presence does not anymore pull us down as a county, but in fact, it pulls us up. The end result, after meeting with his board, was that our rating would have gone down to a AA2 had it not been for the colleges and the economic growth picture that we had painted. When I asked the analysts for our weaknesses so that we could concentrate in the future in ways that we could prepare ourselves better for an upgrade, He responded with, "You really have no weaknesses. Our fund balance levels are strong. The increase in our fund balance policy to 10% helped us a great deal to maintain this high rating." He said they used the ending fund balance compared to revenues. That ratio was 17.7% for actual 2012. That was a key indicator. He remarked that the fund balance would have to go up to about 20% to get us close to the AAA mark. I asked for comparative rating information from other New York counties. Only two New York counties, the only two New York counties that have AAA ratings are Orange County and Westchester County. How many counties in New York are AA1, which is a rating that we maintain? There are only six AA1 counties in New York, including Tompkins County. So all in all, we are in the top eight counties in New York. What else would help us to get a AAA rating? Unfortunately, a lot of the qualifying data is demographic, and we probably cannot influence those numbers. For example, they use the wealth level indicator for our population. They need to see our median family income equal or exceed 1.5 times the U.S. median family income. Our median family income is 111.9% for the United States, and it's 103.6% of the state of New York. So there's really not that much that we can do to help in that area. The analysts also said that tax base as a size is important, as are other demographics and other outside economic factors, which these factors make up 40% of our overall credit rating. Unfortunately, there's little we can do to influence those types of factors. Another example is tax base or size of your base. Usually a AA1, our current rating, is quite big. A $16 billion tax base is average for a AA1. We are only $6.5 billion taxable and $10 billion total. So we would not normally qualify for a AA1 rating if it were not for other contributing factors. Some of these factors are the positive institutional presence that we've shown him in this last interview, and good economic growth for which we get strong credit marks. And that's pretty much the ups and downs of what the rate reviewers could tell us last Friday. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much, Rick. You said strong institutional presence. That means the universities?
That's basically the universities and other nonprofits in the Tompkins County area.
Okay, so, and then strong economic growth. All right, a couple of people got Frank, Carol, Mike.
Thanks, Martha. Rick, first one, you're not asking us to increase the debt limit, are you? Did they take into consideration as one of the items the amount of tax-exempt property we have in the county?
That's part of the issue, and Joe might want to address this since he was the one that really performed quite nicely last Monday when we had this conference call. But we're currently at 40% on our tax-exempt properties, and I think it's important to let you know that that's not really being held against us at this point because we have such good overall economic growth, both in existence right now and planned over the next 3 years.
Let me, if I can wedge in and just explain how we presented this to the rating agencies. We basically said that this has always been a detriment. It's dragging us down. But if they look at it a different way, it's almost as if you have to ask yourself, what if there had been a new Empire Zone program or this new startup program? But there's a bargain made, and the bargain is that you give up future property taxes, but in return you hope for economic benefits that exceed the lost property taxes. So if you take that as your paradigm, And you understand that there have been several square miles of property in this county where the property taxes have been foregone because of that kind of development. But look at what has happened in return for that. It's 14,000 jobs. It's $2 billion in annual economic impact. It's high property values in the neighborhoods because of supply and demand. So we tried to take some of the edge off of that argument, because it's always one that comes back to slap us in the face. Just a couple of other things, and Rick did a really good job, and I thought it was a really tight presentation. We also talked a lot about our unemployment rate here, which we know is among the lowest in New York State. I think there's one county, Hamilton County. I don't know what they do, but it's like 4%. I think there are four people in Hamilton County. But we are number two in New York State, but we also looked at 372 MSAs in the country to see where we rank. And I think we're 55th of 372, which is pretty good in terms of our unemployment rate. But if you carve out only the northeastern U.S., we have the fifth lowest unemployment rate in the northeast United States in terms of metropolitan areas. So we tried to bring some of these things to the table. And again, because of what Rick did in the postmortem in asking, you know, where are we still weak? I think we want to look at median income the next time, because as long as we have all those students living up on the hills, our median income is going to be low, so maybe we want an economist to help us address that point. So I think we just keep hammering away at this. We understand where our weak points are, and we address those. I think the next time we have Gene McFeeters or Michael Stamm on the phone call. Because I got to tell you, this is a AAA county, a very strong county, and I just think we keep hammering away at this, and maybe we hope for a positive outlook as a half tick up leading to a AAA. But I think we learned a lot, again, through what Rick did with the agency after that rating.
Just one final congratulations. Good report.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I've got Carol, Mike, Brian, Pat, and Pam.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how I want to talk about this. I was going to go where Frank was. I agree. It was an incredibly lucid report and great work with the state. It does seem a little bit like we're talking out of both sides of our mouths to say we are impacted by the fact that we've got 40% tax exempt, but we're explaining why we're not and how they strengthen. And I mean, I don't see a solution for this other than to band together with other college towns and make the argument at federal and state levels that there are really very good federal reasons to keep institutions of higher education tax exempt. And there are very good reasons at the state level to have those institutions be tax exempt, but less clear reasons locally where they rely on our services. And that's not an argument that we can make here or that we can impact here without banding together with others. But then we wouldn't have to be speaking out of both sides of our mouth in situations like this. And I also think maybe there's something we can do with I don't know if there's something that we do in terms of how we report household size and the group living situations engendered by the colleges that it then impacts where we stand in median household income. I also have a question for Jonathan, and he'll come back around to me that got passed over. Thanks.
Mike?
Rick, I thought that was a very well-done report. You explained it very thoroughly, and I really appreciated it. But what I'm taking from it is the reason we can't get AAA is we aren't rich enough here. But I would think in some of these AAA counties, you mentioned Orange and Westchester, that even though they have more wealth, they also probably have a lot more debt. And the reason for the bond ratings, as I understood, was to gauge the chance of default. And I think we're strong enough that that chance is pretty small, but apparently the bond raters don't agree with us.
And that is a major factor in their determining our overall rating, the debt factor as well as our fund balance, the finances, the hard numbers are things that we can control, at least over time we can control. But like I said, that's only 60% of the equation. Things that are more
externally driven, external economic factors, demographics, those are things that we really can't control that well. Yet that contributes to 40% of our rating. So, like you said, we can very much improve our overall debt, but still may not impact us being able to move up to a higher credit rating.
Brian, Pat, and then Pam.
Thanks, Martha. Actually, it's good to know, Joe, that apparently you're not trying to get a job in Hamilton County, so that's good. Is it safe to say that without the due diligence of this team that our bond rating may very well have gone down instead of up?
Well, I learned some things that we had a very able team here that were working together to make this happen. And I would believe that every time we go out for debt, whether it's a refinancing like this or new money like we will be dealing with in about 6 months, we're always going to be under pressure to do the very best job that we can and keep our figures calculated closely and make the best presentation possible. To the extent that we get a chance every 6 months, it's a lot of work. I can't say it's fun or enjoyable to work that hard on something that you might get, you know, it's just, but we will be doing it again in 6 months. And Joe said we might even, I'd have to look at the cost involved, but there's always a chance that we could go to one of the other rating agencies like Standard & Poor's or Fitch, and we can give that a try also to see what rating we would get from those agencies.
Okay, I heard you say that all of your arguments that you had to raise your rating was actually told by them to you that's what kept you where you were. So without saying that, there was a good chance that we could have gone down. Is that safe to say?
That's what the report, that's what the rate analyst told me on the day that the report was given.
Okay. Thanks. Good job.
Yes, that saves us a lot of money. How much, in terms of borrowing costs, what does each, as you said, a half
stick? I can't really predict how many basis points that would earn us or cost us if we stayed at the same rating. All I know is that the markets are so volatile right now. When we looked at this a month ago, the rates had gone up quite a bit, and we were about ready to shelve the whole deal because if you had projected it out another 2 months from where they were a month ago, it wouldn't have paid off to even do the refinancing. But then somehow the rates swung back down about 2 weeks ago. Unfortunately, there's a couple political things going on right now that just might impact overall economics of the whole United States. Yep. So between now and November 5th, when we price these bonds, a whole lot of stuff can happen. And that's what's got my eye, more importantly, is just to see how these rates really go up or go down and move in the next 3 weeks. That's what we really have to be concerned around.
Pat and then Pam.
Okay. Ryan touched on part of what I was going to ask you about, Rick. But the other thing, do you happen to know who the other, which of counties are the ones, the other five counties that have the double head one?
They gave that to me. I don't have it written down right now. I know it's Tioga and the rest I can't remember, but I can email that to you tomorrow because I did write it down.
Okay, thank you.
Pam.
Well, I don't really. First place, thank you, Rick. That was an excellent report. But I don't understand how they can include the fact that there's so much tax-exempt property in Tompkins County, particularly because it's in the New York State Constitution that property be tax-exempt. I mean, to me, it would, in my mind, increase the stability of Tompkins County, knowing that despite the fact that 40% of the property in Tompkins County is tax exempt, that we have managed to to not just survive, but do quite well under all kinds of different economic circumstances. So this is baffling that this would be seen as a negative, and that is unfortunate. And Joe, I think your idea of perhaps talking about the median income in Tompkins County is a good tack, because I know that in fact it's the median income has been low enough, and certainly in the city, for the city to be eligible for high distressed areas, because the median income was low enough. So, and that's always been sort of a false figure. So I think that's a good idea. Thank you so much for that.
Peter, and then Will.
God, I hate to prolong this discussion, but frankly, it sounds crazy to me for anyone to worry about how much tax-exempt property we have. Seems to me that what they ought to be interested in is how much non-exempt tax property we had, given, you know, to relate that to how much money we're spending or something like that. I mean, if you say it points against us that we have tax-exempt property, then I say, well, okay, all we have to do is get rid of Cornell and Ithaca College, just demolish them, and then we'll have a better bond rating. I doubt that very seriously. The whole argument doesn't make any sense to me.
We don't have a racetrack.
In other words, a better measure would be for the tax base we have,
right,
what's our capacity, or for the income level of the people in the in the counties. It does seem to me you might want to look. I mean, if you said, okay, the wealth of Orange or Westchester County, maybe proportionally, they should have 40% in their reserves, not 20%. It's an interesting argument. I mean, if you kind of normalize it, as Joe, as you did for us when you pulled statistics on our property tax spending per capita, sort of if you look at it that way. And since you got to go back in 6 months anyway, you know, give you something else to look at.
But this is the corner that we kind of turned in this last rating, where it's always been negative, negative, negative. And for the first time, we said to them, you know, there's a silver lining in here that you need to understand and think about. The 14,000 jobs and the $2 billion of impact and the stability that those institutions offer. Mm-hmm. And they seem to accept that argument. So we are trying to turn that corner.
All right. I've got Will and then Frank and then back to Carol.
Thank you. And I, too, want to thank you for the effort. I hope it is not utterly eclipsed by what is happening outside our county, but I fear it might. As I was driving to this meeting tonight, I heard that Fitch, which I understand is the third largest rating agency after Moody's and Standard & Poor's, has just put the United States government on a negative watch list. And Rick, you probably know better than I what that means, but apparently it's not good news. And
the bonds are bound.
Yeah. And I guess my question, does that have... am I not right? My assumption that what happens out there will could affect all of us. Is it?
Of course. You know, that's what we've been. That's what I was alluding to between the debt ceiling and that vote that needs to take place and how they work around that, and also with coming up with a budget or some kind of CR. It all ties into what's happening in the marketplace, and you can turn it on and watch it on TV every day or every night. And things will happen. It's just, where will we end up on November 5th, on the day that we price our bonds?
Frank.
Yeah, just a quick reminder, two things that Joe did mention were, in addition to the property tax exemptions, there are the effect of the students in the county. Peter's suggestion, or I don't think he suggested this, he just observed it. We're not going to blow up the university or the college, but that may get, that you may suppose that or get rid of the tax exemptions, but you have you know, X number of students in both places that bring our average income down. The corollary is some of the highest paid incomes in the county are at the college and the university. Not all of them, but some of the highest. I don't know that retired physics professors are in that category, but perhaps they are.
We lead it.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else for Rick? Carol, you had a different thing?
I had something for Jonathan. On his report.
Thank you very, very much, Rick.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it was really important to have this conversation. We really appreciate it. And thank you for your efforts along with Joe. And I'm sure David participated in preparation of the strategy. Thank you. Carol, back to Jonathan.
Yeah, I was just interested. The statistics that you were talking about had to do with numbers of cases of assigned counsel that turned out that we weren't necessarily responsible for.
Right, where individuals had been assigned counsel, that counsel had worked for them, the assigned counsel program pays the assigned counsel, and then it's realized that that person probably should not have been assigned counsel, then we can try to get the money back from them.
Right. And then can you tell us anything about sort of the demographics of those that you found? Were they people with addresses outside the county? Were they associated with the institutions? Was there any...
No, I don't really have any breakdown on the demographics. The only demographic that, you know, that is significant really is the income level. And they had income levels above that which should have gotten assigned counsel.
On their own, not just based on their parents that who might have been responsible?
Yeah, it's typically based on their own.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Ready for the consent agenda. I have a couple of resolutions and appointments. If there's anything to be pulled, just holler. Resolution A, number 4414, authorizing social services to accept grant and contract with to accept grant and contract with Child Development Council for FAR public-private partnership. Resolution B, ID 4405, budget adjustment to accommodate the early home energy assistance program outreach. Office for the Aging. Resolution C, ID 4391, payment of multi-year tourism capital grants, 2013. And Resolution D, ID 4390, designation of tourism promotion agency for the state. And appointment to the Criminal Justice Advisory and Alternatives to Incarceration Board, Amber Driscoll, and to Family Court Advisory Council, Vardine Jerry Galacci and Marissa Matsudera.
Can I ask a question first on B?
Well, Kathy Lou set her hand up.
I just don't know if I need to take it off or not. So can I just ask a question? Point of information?
Why don't you do that during the Health and Human Services Committee report? Or?
No, I just don't know if I can vote on it.
Well, you can
I
just say off then.
Then off.
Okay. Go back to B as off. And Kathy Lou moves and Frank seconds the consent agenda. All in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Now, I understand. I recognize some public safety people over there. Hi, Lee. Brian, would you like to take your report?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Public Safety Committee met at 4:45 today. Most of the time was spent on the resolutions that I'll get to here in just a second. One point of note was the undersheriff, Derek Osborne, was there, and he reported that board outs were running at 8, and that seemed to be fairly consistent number, which fits in real well with the proposed expansion of 7, just to demonstrate the potential savings that's going to generate. Lee, why don't you go ahead and come on up, because I'm sure there's going to be some questions up here. I would...
Before you go to that, before your resolutions?
Yes.
The comment from the OAR board, from Kevin Kelly, board chair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't help me understand if we increase this bed size by 7, compared to having those 7 boarded out. Do you see any increase somehow in
workload,
or in fact, is it easier because you don't have people at a distance?
I believe that would turn out to be a savings, because those folks are still receiving services, and you know, it's certainly much easier to have those services in-house as opposed to potentially maybe even having to bring them back, which creates more of a transport problem. We have not gotten that report. It's the first I heard of it today, but I'm glad you brought that up, because as he was saying that, I was thinking just that, that's probably going to turn out to actually be a savings in resources. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Would like to move, and I apologize, some of these things, there were changes to both, so bear with me. I don't have the resolution number, but it's ID number 4421 as revised and approved by Public Safety, Budget Adjustment, Emergency Response. And I would move that, and then I have a brief explanation.
Second by Peter.
Thanks. I'm not sure if this has made to your packet yet or not, and we'll have Lee explain it, but there's – well, why don't you just explain it?
I don't know if I can do as well as Joe did with public safety, but I'll take that up. What the resolution –
do you have a copy of the one you're moving?
All I have is it's the account – numbers, Peter, that we had in committee.
Wait, I'm a little confused. 4421 is H.
20.
The temporary position.
20.
20. Okay, and that's I.
Got it.
Okay. My copy doesn't have a letter on it.
Okay.
Substitute H.
Well, we're going to take I. We're here with I. So it's a budget adjustment, and you're saying the only thing that's different are the account numbers?
Yeah. Yes. And if anyone needs an explanation on that.
Kathy Luce?
Well, I'm just concerned if I is related to H, then we would be moving the budget adjustment before we created the temporary positions. Is that true or not?
It's not.
So the budget adjustments are not related to the temporary positions?
That's correct.
Okay.
All right. Are there any other questions on I, the budget adjustment?
Oh, I see. It's for uninterrupted power supply.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Ready to vote? All in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
That's unanimous. Okay.
And I would like to move Resolution H, ID 4421, as revised as adopted by committee, creation of temporary positions, Department of Emergency Response.
Second by Dave. Discussion? Kathy Luce.
Thank you. I imagine this came up at the committee. It's especially relevant in the light of our discussion about living wage. When I see the notion of temporary workers, I wonder if this is going to be something where we're going to be paying living wage, whether we're going to be paying benefits. And it sounds pretty forthright. Otherwise, it sounds as though, and this is where y'all need to correct me because I think I may be wrong, positions are being created in order to create a pool of trained people that full-time employees will be drawn from, or is it even better than that?
I think it's multifaceted, and it's broken up into two parts, and I could not begin to explain it as eloquently as our county administrator.
You want me to try?
Or Lee, which
I can take the temporary assistant part. That would be directly related to temporary projects that are most frequently funded by grant funds that we've received through State Homeland Security Program. As to the livable wage question, there's a range that personnel sets, and I think it ranges from $10 or $12 to $17 an hour for that temporary work, and we tend to be...
It would not be below living wage. You can be assured that it would not be below the living wage.
And fringe and all that is with...
You know, I can't recall if we pay project assistance fringe benefits.
There's a 10% fringe benefit rate that goes with it, but because of the temporary nature, there's generally no extension of any benefits when these projects come on. They're pretty short-lived, 3-6 months. Quite typically, they're... You know, students that are part of a pool that we've looked to apply some of their studies towards.
Peter and then Jim.
I thought they would train people, Lee. That they tended to be people that were retired. Isn't that correct or not?
Not for the project assistant.
Oh, we're on the project. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Joe.
Yeah, just let me see if I can just kind of summarize the two things that are involved here. One, the creation of two project assistants. The second is the creation of two additional dispatch positions. So that's what's being proposed in this resolution. There are two needs that relate to each of those. With respect to the project assistants, as has been laid out in the resolution, from time to time we receive grant monies, and there's a staff need that goes along with that we don't. It's extraordinary. It relates to the grant. And as this county has done historically, we use project assistance often to meet those staffing needs. But Lee's roster doesn't have that. He doesn't have any authorized project assistance in his roster. So he's asking for two of those to be created. Again, it would pay living wage or more, so that when a grant like the current interoperable grant comes along, he's able to bring people in to staff the requirements of that grant. And when the grant expires, the money go away, those positions go off the payroll until another grant comes on, and he's got the authority to, again, use grant money to bring in project assistants to staff it. So that's the project assistant band of positions that's in here. The second is an even more vexing situation at the 911 center, where the roster is currently authorized at a strength that is very limited. It really is the number of people who are actually working there right now. So let's say that a dispatcher decides that they're going to retire. That roster is so tight right now that we can't bring somebody in to backfill that vacancy until the vacancy occurs. So there's no opportunity to bring somebody in for training and an overlap under his current roster, which means that the individual retires, the incumbent retires, the new person comes on soon after that person retires, but for the first several months of employment, they can't work the console because they're not trained. So they have to go through a training period. While they're going through that training period, the only way to fill the vacancy left by the incumbent is through overtime. It's a very costly way of doing that. So what's been proposed in this resolution is to create the roster flexibility to anticipate vacancies, to bring people in so there's a reasonable period of overlap, and then when that incumbent goes away, the individual can slide into that permanent position and the roster comes back down. The savings is in overtime. There would clearly be an overtime savings if this happens. It's also on employee stress, because you can only work so many overtime hours, particularly in a 911 center, before that stress begins to take a toll. So this proposal would address both of those things. That's the intent
of
the resolution.
So this is just to create, you know, like you got an egg carton with 16, you know, whatever. This is just to create, you know, four more slots for eggs, but not to buy the eggs yet.
Better put. That's
okay.
Great.
Jim.
Two things. Those of you who've been here a while will know what we've done with project assistance. Been through HR for many years that I've been around, and we have never paid less than $15 an hour that I know of, never more than $17. And some of those PAs have graduated on to full-time county employment. What I view Lee's two open, or his quest for some positions, to it sounds to me like succession planning. When David Squires retired, he gave us a long time in advance. We were able to hire Rick, and David was here to help him through the hard times or the beginning times and go through a couple of bond rating things. So that's what he's trying to do here. And I think it's, for his kind of an operation, it's extremely important to have that kind of flexibility.
Carol.
Yeah, so how would these positions show up? First of all, will they show up? Are they there already in our budget books for next year? And then how would they show up there, the change, how would it show up in our roster of FTEs?
They would show as authorized positions on the payroll ledgers, but as far as funding as with the FTEs in your budget, there would be no impact. You would still be funding the same number of FTEs. We're not asking for any additional dollars. This is just the ability to add personnel within the roster. And there are probably dozens of positions that haven't been filled across the county organization that are authorized to be used but not funded, but that's something you can draw upon when a vacancy occurs or is about to occur.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm asking how they'll look in that listing so that next year or the year after I will know to think to look and ask, are those still those positions, and are they still funded by this grant, or have you built it in?
If you're looking into the budget document, they won't show. Just what you see in the budget document will be the authorized funded positions.
And we bring funding in from property tax and from our general fund, and sometimes from grants that are achieved. But so that's how it'll show up. Peter?
Yeah, I've been through this so many times I ought to understand it. But now I'm a little bit mixed up as to where the money comes from. I mean, do we have an ongoing grant that enables us to do whatever we want with it, or what? I mean, I got the fact. The slot is there, but it's not funded. Now, what happens when there's a need for it? Where is that money going to come to pay that person who will be an extra?
Well, I'll give you an example, Peter. We have state homeland security grant funds that have been used at different times to fund, for instance, the computer-aided dispatch system. And in one case, we're implementing enhancements to that where we would need some GIS, geographical information system assistance. I can get some state grant funding to support that specific project on a limited basis, and with the award of that grant, you would see it through a budget adjustment and an acceptance of that grant award directed specifically toward that project assistance purpose.
Okay, so what, in my words, what you're saying is you have grants that are flexible enough so that you can get the money from them to fund this when the need comes up. Is that right?
That's correct. That's
okay,
what I'm anticipating.
Yeah.
Kathy Luce.
Thanks. I'm getting a better understanding of this. It seems to me that this resolution is doing two things. And one of the things, I have no problem supporting. The other is, as more questions are asked and answered, I may be able to support and I may not. And that's the hiring new dispatchers on a temporary basis. I'm not sure that it seems to be as cost-effective as it is kind of bypassing our regular hiring process. And I'd like to move to separate these.
Joe.
Well, before you do that, though, and it may be a matter of terminology, The individuals who will be brought on in the dispatch positions will not be temporary employees. Those positions will be used temporarily until a permanent vacancy is freed up, and that individual will then slide into that permanent position.
Are they full-time employees?
They would be full-time employees, yeah.
So they would be regular full-time employees?
All that. They would be hired just the way we hire anyone else. And again, all we're trying to do is get a head start on vacancies so we don't incur large overtime costs when a vacancy occurs. That's all that's being requested here.
Well, it sounds to me as though this is a really reasonable way then to help alleviate extra costs from overtime. It's just confusing to me to talk about them as temporary positions, because if what I'm hearing now is true, they would go through the regular vetting and recruitment and selection process, and they would also be subject, these employees in the second half of the resolution would get all the benefits and fringes of an ordinary employee. Is that correct?
That's correct. It would be a temporary change to your roster, but they would become full-time employees.
Well, to me, it still sounds as though these are two different, completely different things, and I would still like to make a motion to separate. I think that's where the confusion is coming from, and for me, that would be a much cleaner way to do it. It doesn't look as though there's much support for that, but I think that this could lead to problems in the future, and the wording of it is a real concern to me.
If I can address the wording question, because Kathy's got the word temporary circled in the title over here, that they're actually, we probably shouldn't say temporarily. It's more like, so look at the second whereas. These projects often require the assignment of staff temporarily to meet grant and program goals rather than temporary staff. And I know Dooley's not here, but somebody has to do this. So, but the issue of temporary staff, that I think is, am I saying that right, Kathy? That's actually a problem, that as Joe just said, we're not hiring people for 6 months. It's not like the highway staff, the summer highway staff who fill out our road crews. These are people who are being put into a slot temporarily until the regular position opens up. Carol?
Yeah, I would suggest the word pre-fill, creation of pre-fill positions, and is that just...
Well, again, there's two different types that we're looking at here. One of the project assistants, and their employment will be of a temporary duration. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to say temporary there. Of a temporary duration. The other category that we're looking at are the dispatchers. Those are not temporary employees. That's what do you want to call it, pre-fill, or again, I said we're trying to get a head start on vacancies. Those are full-time permanent positions that would be hired under the normal civil service rules.
So can we refer to specific, there's no line numbers here, but the second whereas that Martha referred to, can I move that we switch, these projects often require the assignment of staff temporarily, or staff on a temporary basis to meet grant and program goals? Would that be friendly?
As long as we're representing this honestly, this is the whereas that refers to those project assistants that have limited durations.
I'm going to go to the committee chair here.
Okay. Carol. Pre-fill on the other one.
Let's see if the chair can work this out.
I doubt it, but we'll try. At least in my eye, in both scenarios, the first scenario is pretty clear that they are on a temporary basis. That go away when the grant funds are exhausted or the project is done. In the second instance, where we are basically creating a succession plan for dispatchers, I would suggest that they too, because of the roster size, they too, even though we are paying them, they walk like full-time, get benefits like full-time, they are still temporary until that position is actually vacated, and then they go to that position. Otherwise, we are going to be creating a bigger roster.
All right, I'm going to try to look for a solution here. I got Peter.
My solution is to forget about it. I think we have a good idea here. People are seeing something that's wrong in there. It's not. These are not temporary in the sense that we're hiring someone for a job, but we got to train them in advance. And so during that training period, they're going to be people who are on our permanent roster, but they're not doing the job. So that's what we got. I think we have an ingenious solution to a problem, and we're worried too much about the wording, frankly. I mean, I know it's complicated because it took me 3 or 4 times until I really understood it. But now that I understand it, I'm just ready to vote for this. It's the right thing to do, and I wouldn't worry all that much about the words.
All right, I'm going to go to Joe in a minute, but I'm going to suggest that perhaps we take our break, and the smartest people in the room should huddle and figure out what to do with this, and it might be, as Kathy Lou suggests, a separation of the two, or maybe not. But even separating, it's not going to be easy. There's going to be some...
Hard to separate.
It's going to be some juggling, but I don't want to... We shouldn't do that while
there's
everybody's waiting.
There's additional issues that need to be addressed.
Okay, so if there's a... I'll go to Joe and then Jonathan.
Well, we were going to say the same thing.
Oh, you want to say the same thing? Okay, 1, 2, 3, go.
Okay, so the three people here have talked about it.
So I think the best solution is to cut out the word temporary in the title and cut out the word temporary in the second whereas, and I think it works.
Is that what you were going to say, Joe?
Yes.
Okay, is that friendly to the mover and seconder?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, Kathy Luce.
Thanks. The reason that I have confusion, and I appreciate your indulgence while I come to an understanding of what this entails, is that there are two different hiring methods, and there are two different ways that HR will look at these employees. And we worked really hard to establish, and the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee had a big part in assuring that the program assistants were vetted for diversity, and that this was an opportunity for us to bring into the community of employees talent that fulfills our needs and that is a good fit for us. However, these positions are vetted in a different way. So if we put both of these in the same resolution, but they're two different kind of employees, the confusion that exists might be that one kind of hiring procedure would apply to the other. And in the other case, it's my understanding that this is a bargaining unit position, which also, maybe I'm wrong there, but if it is, then certain terminology would be appropriate and other terminology would not. Therefore, I believe that this should be separated into two separate resolutions. I also would like to have a reminder of the kind of vetting for diversity that program assistants undergo and an assurance that in this situation, good paying job, one that could lead into some other...
It happens, Kathy.
Some other possible permanent employee position, that there be an assurance of that, because certainly in the Department of Emergency Response and in this setting, having such diversity would be a terrific addition and supplement. So because of those concerns, I would really, for me, to get my support, I would really need to have these separated and to discuss and hear some reassurance about the procedure for these program assistants.
It's my understanding that project assistant across other departments carries with it, that term carries with it, what the kinds of criteria and processes that you're talking about, Kathy Lou. So it's, So by calling them project assistants, that says, that
brings with it. I'm asking for reassurance from Joe and from Lee Shurtleff.
Right. So the question is that, you know, does that term, is that sufficient in this resolution to indicate the kind of processes?
No, I'm not asking for that. I'm asking for them to tell me that that's what's going to happen with these positions.
I can represent that, yes. Project assistants are titles, as you well know, that were here long before I was here. So there is a tradition of practice that personnel has applied for some time in terms of trying to reach out to a diverse community to fill these positions. So that would certainly hold true here as it would if they were created in any other county department.
So by virtue of that title being used...
And how's yeah. that with you, Lee?
That's fine. I can't even begin to imagine all of the different ways in which this may be applied, but the important thing is that the slots be available when the opportunity presents itself, and we'll follow whatever policies or desires the legislature has in filling those.
I'm really happy to hear that, and I look forward to the results.
Carol, Pam, Brian.
Yeah, so I'm still having a problem with the word temporary in the second to last whereas. And to me, there's an HR term, I believe, that is pre-fill. I wrote grant proposals for Cornell University, using that terminology from our HR department. There may be others that also apply, but that's the one to me that we don't want to be hiring people telling them that it's temporary and in the same way that you would a temporary
so
person.
Pre-fill indicates that they will be moved into the position that will be filled.
Yeah, well,
right?
Assuming they meet all the
that
other criteria
right.
and pass the whatever probationary periods we have. So I would change that in some way to either the flexibility to pre-fill new dispatchers or to hire new dispatchers on a pre-fill basis or to hire new dispatchers in advance of vacancies, if you don't like that term.
Okay. Peter, Brian and Peter, does pre-fill work instead of temporary there?
All right, with me, I've only heard that word in Cornell. I don't know if it's a common HR word or not, but that certainly is what a pre-fill is. You hire a person in the anticipation that somebody's going to retire, but generally it's a time scale of years, not a time scale of a month.
The only caution, if I may, is again, it's back to the flexibility issue. Let's take it another direction. Suppose I've got long-term disabilities that I'm aware of, and I've got to bring somebody back to fill in for a period of time temporarily. That may be part of the equation that we're looking at. Most of the time, the situation is that we want to get ahead of a retirement or somebody leaving the workforce, but it's the ability to have that staffing level and maintain it.
Okay. Pam, then Brian, then Jim.
I just wanted to say that in the future, I would suggest that project assistance be put forward in separate resolution than a regular permanent employees, because it obviously causes a lot of confusion and consternation. And I think we'll save ourselves a lot of time if we just separate them out in the future, if we don't want to do that tonight.
Brian?
I guess I was asking Carol, or it was to your point. Where did you say you wanted to take out?
The second to last whereas. Now, is referring to not the project assistants, right? That's referring to hiring the dispatchers. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yes. So the word temporary there.
Okay.
I just thought that the points that Kathy raised and
okay.
that I would have been concerned about applied to that one as well.
Okay. Except for in the example that Lee just gave you, in that you would be doing someone a disservice if you hired them off the civil service list to cover a long-term disability where the expectation is that person will eventually be coming back to their own position. In that case, you may want someone that doesn't have, that's not going to have an expectation of a permanent full-time job. Maybe they just retired from there. They still have all the certifications. They are ready to go, but they can fill in on a temporary basis while someone is out with whatever. It doesn't matter. Which will get the complement of staff up to where it needs to be on a temporary basis. So I'm not comfortable with taking that out.
Right. Well, this is a new wrinkle we just heard. So does it work to say pre-fill or temporary basis?
Yeah, because it could be either. Sure.
Okay, with the mover or the seconder? Peter?
Yeah, that's okay with me.
All right. Maybe we've solved the problem there. Jim and then Kathy Luce.
I'm going to do what I do best and call the question.
Second.
I wasn't allowed to speak.
Okay. All in favor of calling the question?
With or without that word in there?
They've already accepted pre-fill or. Yeah. One, call me questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Opposed? 9-4, that passes. So with the changes that we, see if I get this right. We took temporary out of the title. We took temporary out of the second whereas. And to the second to last whereas, we added pre-fill or, so that it reads, to hire new dispatchers on a pre-fill or temporary basis. That's the motion on the table. All in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? 12-1, that passes.
I agree with what Pam said about separating these in the future. I think this is going to lead to some confusion, and I regret that my colleagues weren't willing to separate this.
All right. Ryan, is there anything else in your report? Those are the resolutions, right?
It is. And that's the end of my report. And just like today, the next scheduled meeting of the Public Safety Committee falls on a holiday. That would be Veterans Day. So stay tuned, and we'll come up with an alternative date.
Okay, that's the issue with Monday meetings. So, all right, let us take a 10-minute recess and then come back. Thanks very much, Brian. All right, we'll be back in your seats in 10 minutes. Thank you.